Welcome to the graduate student paper session. My name is Andrea Buchner. I am the director of the Gruslipper Digital Laboratory at the Center for Jewish History. I was a presenter here last year, and so I know that this is a great opportunity for graduate students to present their research in a friendly and relaxed environment. And it is also a very good opportunity for the audience to learn more about the vibrant state of graduate student research in the field of archival studies. I will introduce each speaker prior to their talks. Everybody will speak for about 15 minutes, and then there will be time for questions. Our first speaker is Eric Fritzler. He is currently the processing archivist at the Ruther's Labor Archives at the Library of Labor and Urban Affairs in Detroit. He will soon graduate with a master's degree in library and information science with a certificate in archival administration from Wayne State University. And prior to his studies in library science, Eric earned a master's degree in philosophy. And he has taught philosophy courses at Western Michigan University and Wayne State University. And the title of his paper is The Use of Foxonomies in Archives, Democratization of Description and Overcoming the Difficulties Associated with Social Tagging.
Good afternoon, everyone. All right, to get started. Sorry, it's friendly setting. I'll get started. All right. In recent years, there has been some focus on the potential benefits and disadvantages associated with the collaborative or social tagging of websites and online resources. Librarians, scholars, and information scientists have commented on the appearance of social tagging and foxonomies and its relevance to libraries, cultural institutions, and searching on the internet. As a result, questions have emerged regarding the usefulness or proper application of social tags and foxonomies, in addition to the impact that the application of user-generated tagging may have on traditional, professionally generated metadata. First, let's define what is meant by social tagging and a foxonomy. Social tagging is a method for generating descriptive metadata for many purposes. So one of the things I've offered up here is just there with a photo, probably the easiest way to illustrate. You know, we could offer up cat, feline, gray, furry, or if somebody had a strong pair of eyes and wanted to focus in on the books in the background, there are a collection of Sinclair Lewis books. Sorry. It is fair to suggest that user-generated tags may perform numerous functions. Tags may be used for later retrieval, describing a digital object, informing others, categorizing objects, and to create a community of like-minded users. In his 2004 article, Mathis notes that a foxonomy lowers the barrier to cooperation. Groups of users do not have to agree on a hierarchy of tags or detailed foxonomy. They only need to agree in a general sense on the meaning of a tag enough to label similar material with terms for there to be cooperation and shared value. A foxonomy emerges from the practice of many individuals tagging the resources that they see and use. In her 2007 article, Krosky explains that a foxonomy is created from the aggregate of user-created tags within a website and therefore provides an inclusive categorization scheme reflective of the collective intelligence of that community. Given the proliferation of information available online, professionally generated description of every web resource does not seem to be a feasible approach. Consequently, social tagging and foxonomies may present a timely method for describing websites and resources found online. The subject of this paper will deal with the potential applications of social tagging and foxonomies in an archival setting. As archival repositories make portions of their collection available online, I argue that archival repositories would benefit from allowing researchers and archival users to generate their own metadata tags for archival items. Likewise, it could benefit the researchers or archival users. However, social tagging practices are not perfect. There are difficulties commonly associated with social tagging and foxonomies that detract from the possibility of utilizing user-generated tags. Some social or collaborative tagging can lead to problems with synonymy or lack of precision when searching for specific categories of digital items. Without specific and accurate tags, online searches will retrieve many irrelevant matches. Nevertheless, if these difficulties were alleviated, a mutually beneficial relationship between taggers and archival repositories could flourish online. Very little consideration has been made of the potential use of social tagging in an archival setting and the impact that folksonomies could have on archives. In a 2006 article, Elizabeth Yackel notes that a reason for this could relate to the traditional interaction between an archivist and archival user. Yackel explains that the relationship between an archivist and researcher is typified by mediation. The researcher wants access to rare and unique archival materials as primary sources, and likewise, the archivist provides supervised access to researchers and assists researchers with specific questions about archival collections. Explicitly stated, the assumption may be that if researchers can tag archival items with descriptions of their own choosing, then there would be no need for reference or processing archivists. However, this assumption is an error on the part of the archival community for at least two reasons. First, it is unlikely that the entire contents of archival repositories will be placed online. As a result, researchers would continue to visit the relevant archival repository for primary sources. At archival repositories, researchers would continue to engage with reference archivists in traditional interactions. Second, as archival collections are acquired, very few collections are ready to be released to the public without any processing and arrangement. Archivists will be indispensable for preserving and processing a collection, answering questions regarding an archival collection, and providing access to physical material. If archival items were digitized and made available online, social tagging would allow a researcher to describe, using their own terms, in interaction with an archival item made available online. This possibility may displace some of the mediation between an archivist and archival material, but does not damage the original source material, nor diminish the need for consultation of additional material and knowledge found at the physical repository. Although social tagging is not necessarily the ideal tool for improving archival description, collaborative tagging presents a timely method for alleviating some of the problems that archival institutions consistently experience. Namely, most archival repositories have a significant backlog of unprocessed records, which have little to no description, have to deal with researchers' expectations that archival materials should be processed to the item level, have at least some outdated scope and content notes on finding aids, and may have subject terms that do not reflect a diverse population or community. Consider the aforementioned difficulties in the potential resolution that social tagging and folksonomies could present to archival repositories with digital objects available online. Although there may be a growing trend to resist processing a collection down to the item level, there are many situations where more description of a collection would be desirable both for the archivist and the researcher. In arranging and describing archives and manuscripts, Kathleen Rowe succinctly describes the dilemma that archival repositories face with the proliferation of archival papers, photographs, and items. The goal of archival description is to ensure access to the records. An increasingly perplexing problem for archivists, especially those with modern record collections, is how to accomplish this with a substantial amount of records and the ever-present problem of insufficient staff resources. The trade-off that archival repositories often face between description down to the item level and expedited access to a processed collection could be mitigated by social tagging. Social tagging and folksonomies provide a way to generate inexpensive additional metadata for digital copies of papers or photographs. An archival repository may be limited by time and financial constraints, but still see the need to place archival materials online. If properly publicized and implemented, social tagging could remedy this lack of time and resources in that archival users and researchers could provide description of archival items made available online. Moreover, social tagging could complement a repository that is interested in implementing Green and Meisner's more product-less process method of processing. Once a sufficient level of processing and description has been attained on a particular collection, some or all of an archival collection could be made available for users to view and describe online. Additional description of archival objects could be gradually contributed by archives users through social tagging while collections are efficiently processed and made available. Furthermore, finding aids and archival description may need to be updated to reflect current interests and concerns. Kathleen Rowe explains the need for updating finding aids with an example stating that historians working on the topic of anorexia nervosa have found diaries, medical records, and other information relevant to this topic as early as 1870. None of the archival finding aids provided the medical terms for this disease. although the professional medical literature of that time uses the terminology. While the term was in active use throughout the period when the records were described, the issue was not perceived as an important general topic worth noting in a finding aid. With social tagging, researchers and users of the archival website could utilize their own vocabulary to describe the archival objects as they see fit. The user-generated metadata would presumably capture current interests and be modified by further researchers utilizing and describing the archival objects. Moreover, archival repositories do not always epitomize the viewpoint of those that are marginalized or underrepresented. Social tagging would be one method for archival repositories to solicit descriptive metadata that captures the words and terms used by those populations without skewing an emerging consensus. A community could offer terms and description in their own vernacular, possibly convey the intricate details that make a community unique. In a more rudimentary form, such steps are already being initiated. In her 2005 article, Greenhorn details the results of Project Naming, a series of Canadian governmental and archival initiatives to describe photographs of the names of Inuit that were not recorded, thereby making the photographic material more accessible to the communities and researchers. Archivists and researchers from Library and Archives Canada collaborate with the Inuit elders to correctly identify the individuals in the historical photographs. Although not an example of social tagging, this illustration demonstrates the potential such technologies could unlock in a community to harness social knowledge, especially in terms of local, urban historical societies, and with assistance, historically isolated communities. In making archival material available online, a repository could harness the knowledge of a community to identify discrete details about the content. The identity of an unnamed individual in a photograph, the name of a building no longer standing, the unknown author of a series of personal notes. moving down to, or I don't want to overrun things or run into the next, so I'll move over a few parts. Let's see. Additional steps could also be taken to clarify a tagger's obligation to other participants and researchers, which could also include suggesting synonyms for tag terms and to follow prevalent conventions. By devising some sort of convention for acceptable tags, some of the gibberish or compound words may be better expressed, which would likely be emulated with subsequent users. Consequently, the need to establish some sort of tagging conventions is fundamental for the advancement of social tagging. Another important consideration is the progress and evolution of the interface between user and website. Voss notes that the art of creating interfaces for developed tagging systems is still in its infancy. Following this line of thought, one can argue that tagging will improve as interfaces do. Interface changes can be made to discourage certain practices and to encourage other practices. As a different approach, information scientists have devised computer programs to normalize tags. Given the success and pervasiveness of tagging, several authors note that it is possible to extract information even from tags that may appear to be malformed. In a series of articles, Al-Khalifa and Davis have investigated whether automatic keyword extraction is more reliable than user-generated folksonomies. Encouragingly, they find that in most cases, user-generated tags have greater overlap with how a human indexer would describe websites than an automatic keyword extraction technique. In testing tags, the two authors of the experiment describe the system architecture of a program that they call folk annotation, which normalizes tags so that they can be compared and then extracted to create properly formed semantic metadata. Archival items are often unique but not always processed to the item level. Even with items made available online, further metadata could be contributed to supplement what metadata already exists. Such an arrangement with appropriate outreach to the archival and other relevant communities would be mutually beneficial for both the researcher and the archival repository. The archival repository will gain additional metadata description of archival items in the form of tags. Researchers and archival users will have an opportunity to contribute subject or local knowledge to archival papers or photographs made available online. Social tagging and folksonomies will, in theory, increase researcher interactivities with an archival repository's website and allow researchers to describe archival objects in their own terms. However, social tagging and the resulting folksonomy would not replace the need to visit the physical archival repository, nor the human expertise that is not available online.
Our next speaker is Katie Blank. She will graduate in December 2008 with a master's degree in history and a master's degree in library and information science with an archival studies concentration from the School of Information Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She has worked in the Milwaukee City Archives and Marquette University's Archives and Special Collections, and she is currently the archival studies project assistant at the School of Information Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. The title of her paper is Reclaiming the Past, Social Memory and Access in Native American and Indigenous Communities.
Thanks. Good afternoon. Thank you for coming. I'll just start this off by saying that all three of us felt that it was really hard to address these broad and deep topics. So this paper is more of an overview or a survey, and there's many directions this could go, and I'm glad that SAA is looking at the protocols for Native American documents. In 1855, the Coquille tribe in Oregon signed a treaty with the United States where they were relocated from their tribal lands to a reservation 75 miles away. The treaty, unfortunately, was never ratified. Therefore, they were left out of programs that were normally implemented for Native Americans. Eventually, the tribe in the 20th century, the tribe started to pursue a land claim in federal courts. They found that oral testimonies of the tribal elders did no good and in the courts, and the documentary evidence was needed. Most of the records that would have helped them were miles away in Washington, D.C. Sadly, this story is not uncommon to Native American tribes and indigenous and marginalized people all over the world. In response to that, Native Americans and other indigenous people are creating or adding to their own archives and libraries so they can have access to important information about themselves. They're also creating more Western documentary documents. There are many different issues facing Native Americans in archives. The lack of Native Americans in library and information science programs is one. The absence or lack of funding for Native American archives, issues of ownership, social memory, and who the creators about records of Native Americans were all affect them today. These are too many topics to cover in one paper, so I will focus on the challenges to Native American access to records and what repatriation efforts some tribes have implemented to help preserve social memory. This paper will start with a brief discussion of the Western notions of history and social memory, and documents about indigenous people all over the world were often created by non-indigenous colonizers and settlers. Because of that, there is an inherent bias in the documents. Looking at studies from the Caribbean to Australia and New Zealand into North America, it seems that indigenous and minority populations have had many obstacles to face regarding access to their information. Records about them, in some cases, are hundreds of thousands of miles away. Physical and digital access are also problems due to low levels of infrastructure and income on many reservations. Educational and language barriers also exist. There have been some steps towards promoting and providing access to records, but they are small and slow in coming. And just a brief definition, a very simple definition of social memory, one of them is that it is the collected individual memories of a society, sometimes about an event or just history in general. The validity of traditional archival materials versus oral traditions was put on trial in the case of Delgamuukw versus British Columbia. In the land dispute court case in Canada, a judge ruled that it was impossible to verify who owned the disputed land due to the absence of adequate documentary evidence. Written records and the scholars who used them were seen as reliable, while the oral tradition and the scholars and tribal members who used that for their defense were seen as unreliable in court. Throughout the court case, Western notions of history and accuracy were challenged. This case was not just about land, but was a challenge to the courts to overcome notions of the superiority of Western culture and its methods of communication, preservation, and legitimation of knowledge. A result of this case was that it was the first case in Canada about First Nation land titles that was argued with evidence from Indigenous people. Social memory and oral histories of Indigenous groups have been repeatedly challenged in court cases. This is true with the Coquille, who I described at the beginning. And this led to the SWARP project, which I will talk about later in the paper. There was a 10-year difference between a court case, two different court cases. In the 1930s, they just had used oral testimony, and their case was thrown out. But in 1943, they won their case because they used primary documents from archives, and they brought in an ethnologist. So if a white person said something, it was, legitimate in court. Many times it is thought that records created by dominant groups for their own purposes do not contain information about minority or Indigenous groups. This is not necessarily true. By looking at clues in records, information about these groups can be found. Jeanette Bastian found that in her work in the Caribbean, and she found that traces of people who did not create the records can be found within the records. This is also true in North America. Some researchers, I found this in a history journal, developed a strategy to look at records in New England and find the continued presence of Native American inhabitants, because it was thought, traditionally thought, that there were no Native Americans there after King Philip's War. Many times these colonial records were inconsistent. For example, if Native Americans chose to retain their tax-exempt status, they would not be counted in a census, and therefore there is no official record of them. Also, who created the records about in colonial New England affected how race and ethnicity were viewed. So just because they're in there, it might not be accurate. In the same way, they might be missing because they chose not to pay not to have to pay taxes. So now I'll go on to access. Access to records can be looked at from two different points of view, Native and non-Native. And lack of access can come in many forms. In the United States, physical access due to records being stored away from reservations is a problem. Many times there's a lack of infrastructure on some reservations, not all, but the smaller ones especially. And there's also telecommunications barriers, the digital divide that we all hear about too. So there's many different gaps. There's also the lack of access due to language barriers in some tribes. In the Canadian trial I mentioned before, many of the testimonies from members of the tribe had to be translated into English first to be used in the court case. And of course, we know that access is also reliant on us archivists and librarians at repositories. As we become more aware of the resources available in archives, it is pertinent that we work to provide the best service and access to the records. Archivists should know their collections as much as possible and help Native American scholars and tribes so that they can have access to the documents they need but have no control over. Access does not even necessarily mean having the records within the Native American communities. as Amy Cooper Carey had that experience at the Hetathly, is that correct? Hetathly Museum and Archives on the Navajo Reservation in Arizona. Item collections weren't processed, there were no finding aids, and so she suggested that archivists should shift the focus away from non-Indian repositories and reach out to smaller repositories on the reservations. These suggestions are included in the protocols for Native American archival materials created by the First Archivist Circle and being explored by SAA currently and in another session right now. Another issue explored in the protocols is access restrictions to Native American materials. Access to collections controlled by Native Americans or other indigenous groups is sometimes restricted by the groups due to religious reasons or just other traditional reasons. And some of these restrictions can go against our traditional Western ideals of universal access, although it's been pointed out that many repositories have restricted materials in them. So the question is, if there are potential threats to access by having Native Americans and indigenous groups control their information, why is it so important that they do? The two main reasons that I focused on are legal reasons, so that the tribes can and groups can gain access to their land rights and claims and various other things, and so that they can control their own customs and heritage, therefore preserving their social memory. There have been efforts by Native American tribes to either repatriate or copy records and bring them back home. In addition, there have been collaborative efforts between tribes with archives, libraries, museums, and the government to develop best practices for managing Native American records. Given that challenge of physical access to archival records, some libraries and archives have made collections available online. Thank you. The First Nations collection of the Southern Oregon Digital Archives, SODA, is an example of a digital collection offering access to documents. It was a collaborative project, and the library scanned treaties, native dictionaries, many other materials, and it was labor-intensive, they reported, but it proved to be valuable. A librarian from a small tribal library in Northern California here was able to find 19 documents about her tribe, and the tribes were excited to have access to their native language dictionaries online. Another project is SWARP, which is the most fun to say, I think. And that is the Southwest Oregon Research Project. And it's an example of a tribe that took the initiative and brought records back to the Oregon region. And SWARP was implemented in two phases, one and two. And this was implemented by the Kukil tribe because of the problems they had had in the past. During SWARP 1 in 1995, so this actually happened a little bit ago, 60,000 pages of documents were copied from the National Anthropological Archives and the National Archives. And SWARP 2 in 1998 brought back another 50,000 pages of documents about the tribes. And it was a collaborative effort between the Coquille, the University of Oregon, and the Smithsonian Institution. It was reported that SWARP isn't done and that the tribe has discovered documents about Oregon tribes from regions as far away as Europe, you know, Spain, Russia, Canada, France. And from what I've heard and with discussions with other archivists, that it is not uncommon to have records about tribes in places all over the country and all over the world. And one last project I'll just briefly touch upon is the American Indian Tribal Histories Project at the Western Heritage Center in Billings, Montana. And this is a project that exists to preserve and maintain the cultures of the Native Americans, and it was hoped from the Native American perspective. And it seeks to record the oral histories primarily from the Crow and Northern Cheyenne tribes in the Yellowstone River Valley. And an interesting aspect of this project is that it they produce educational DVDs, and the oral history records and displays are also produced from it. There are also tribal members involved in this. And the DVDs are aimed at classroom use, and they come with a teacher's guide. So that's very nice. These are only a few examples of Native American and Indigenous people gaining some physical and intellectual control over their records. There are many other instances, instances of this throughout the United States and the world. I know there's a lot going on in Australia and New Zealand, especially right now. By gaining access to or physical control of the records, these communities can shape their social memory and continue to strengthen tribal sovereignty. So I just have some recommendations that I think really need to be some places we really need to look at. So through the various collaborative and tribal efforts of Native American communities, Native American communities can now have a more positive attitude about their records. Continued collaboration will be needed between tribes, the federal government, libraries, archives, and museums that contain Native American collections. And I think also international collaboration would be good since these records are dispersed all over. In conclusion, more studies need to be done on the benefits and drawbacks of these collaborative efforts. Also, a survey of the tribal archives would be helpful to gain insight on their programs and problems and the existence, you know, how many exactly are there. I tried to look into that last fall, and it was really challenging, so I would encourage other people to do that too. And lastly, efforts to educate tribal archivists, records managers, and librarians would also be good. A good example of this right now is the serious study of the protocols for Native American archival materials by SAA. Hopefully, practical and applicable outcomes will stem from that. By bringing resources home, the tribes are actively preserving their tribal social memory and complementing their oral histories and other traditions with written documentary evidence, therefore enriching our national and international history. Thank you.
Thank you for this interesting paper. Our final presenter will be Jonathan Ponder. He graduated in April 2008 from the University of Michigan School of Information with the Masters of Science in Information, Specialization Archives and Records Management. He is currently working for JSTOR in Ann Arbor as a production librarian. And prior to his library degree, he earned a master's degree in English literature and has a WBA in history and religion. His paper is entitled Learning from the Past to Face the Future, The Past and the Future in a Site of Adventist Collective Memory.
Good afternoon. Okay, we'll just start right in. Covering an approximately 3-block area in Battle Creek, Michigan, surrounded by and intermingled with local residences and businesses, Historic Adventist Village currently features 7 historic buildings restored to their 19th century appearance that serve as artifacts and exhibit spaces. The village is billed on its website as, quote, a fascinating 3-block experience that includes authentically restored or replicated buildings featuring the heritage of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. I want to start with a little brief background and context on the Adventist Church that will also kind of illuminate later parts of the paper. A Protestant denomination that developed during the Second Great Awakening in mid-19th century America, the Adventist Church grew largely out of the Millerite movement led by William Miller, who preached the imminent return of Christ based on symbolic and mathematical interpretations of the biblical books of Daniel and Revelation. Members of the Advent movement fastened on the date October 22, 1844, as the date that Christ would return to earth and take his followers to heaven. This remains an important event in the history of the Adventist Church and an important point to remember for the thesis of this paper and for later on in the paper. This event that was called the Great Disappointment that resulted from Christ not returning sent the believers back to their Bibles to find an explanation for where they had gone wrong. From this emerged a body of doctrine around which the officially organized Seventh-day Adventist Church soon coalesced. And as I've said, this turns out to be a key to something discussed later in this paper, the tying together of the history and heritage of the heritage focus of the historic Adventist village with a strong future in orientation and a looking forward to the second coming of Christ. The expectation of the soon coming of Christ, which was responsible for the strength and rapid growth of the movement originally, was needed to remain an important part of the church's doctrine, and it did. And how this is connected to Battle Creek and historic Adventist Village, many of the Adventist members and leaders lived in Battle Creek by the mid-1850s, and it kind of became a center for the denomination. And I have just a few pictures here of some of the different buildings. It gives you a little bit of an idea of what the area looks like. These are all, like as I said, these are all within a couple blocks of each other, and it's kind of an enclosed area. And each of the different buildings has a different story and a different kind of slant that's put on it that kind of tries to show something about the church and about its history. And they have different stories that go with them. The goal of my study of the historic Adventist village has been to examine it from the perspective of social or collective memory studies and to explore the why of religious collective memory, and in particular, why a group of Adventists has chosen this particular form for collective remembering. Where does this manifestation of collective memory come from? What is driving it? What do they hope to accomplish by it? The historic Adventist village would seem to be a manifestation of the collective memory of the Adventist church, but just what role does it actually play in that collective memory? To explore these questions, I did a few different things. I visited and took a tour of the village to get a firsthand view. I researched primary source documents associated with the village, a variety of documents in an archives and also that I found at the actual village. And I also applied to the examination some theories on collective memory offered by Pierre Nora, David Lowenthal, and Jacques Derrida. I should also note my personal connection to the topic. I grew up in the Adventist church and have an interest in pursuing this question from that perspective as well. And I think I felt like I brought an interesting perspective as someone who's kind of an insider, but also at this point kind of an outsider and a skeptic and looking at it from with these different lenses and from the perspective of collective memory. I found and concluded two things from my examination. First, drawing from Nora and Lowenthal, I argue that the historic Adventist village reflects a particular story and belief-centered manifestation of the phenomena of sites of memory, which is Nora's term, and the heritage movement, which is described by Lowenthal. This is as opposed to a more strict emphasis on critical history. Both Nora and Lowenthal suggest that stories, legend, and belief are much more important to collective memory and to the cohesiveness of a community than is critical history, which actually tends to be damaging or can be damaging to collective memory and community, especially in contexts where it begins to question where these beliefs and doctrines and things come from that hold a community get together. The historic Adventist village is created from the stories and artifacts of this community for the purpose of nurturing and supporting belief. And as I said, there are examples in the different buildings and stories associated with them. A second conclusion, and the more of the focus of my presentation, draws on Derrida's writing on the archive. My argument is that tied up with the village's focus on history, heritage, and story, there is an even deeper striving to come to terms with the church's past as it relates to the continued expectation of Christ's second coming and salvation. What is most interesting to me about the village is that it is an historical heritage and tourist site sponsored by a religious organization. And so it has this mixed spiritual, historical, and theme park sensibility. They even have kind of tours where people guide you around in costumes and so forth. You've probably seen other sites that do similar types of things. It runs the gamut in its appeal from physical history, material history, to evidence of the historical record, to oral history, to collective memory, and to extremely personal and internal spiritual experience for some visitors. For this reason, the historic Adventist village is an interesting lens through which to focus Jacques Derrida's expanded sense of the archive. In his book, Archive Fever, Derrida presents the archive as something like a continuum that spans between the physical, artifactual, and the spiritual, existential. This kind of idea of a continuum shows up throughout the paper and is important to kind of keep in mind this kind of continuum that he brings into focus. The possible substrates onto which archival memory may be inscribed include physical materials, electronic documents, the individual's physical body, and finally the inner psychic archive of an individual. A psychic archive is one of Derrida's concepts. How does the historic Adventist village function in this expanded space for the archive that Derrida opens up? I argue that the memory and belief archived in this site functions as a shelter to believers from the questions and challenges posed to religious belief by the realities of critical history and the difficulties of existence. So there's this critical history component as well as just the more personal kind of spiritual experience. An interesting theme in some of the writing by Adventist Heritage Ministry, the organization responsible for the village, is of the village as an evangelistic tool. For leaders and many visitors, the village is about nothing less than salvation and eternal life. The stakes are high. It not only supports the beliefs of the community, it also shares the message with others so that they might be saved as well or have that opportunity. Part of the mission statement is, quote, to arouse the interest of visitors who are not acquainted with the Seventh-day Adventist history and beliefs. An example of the evangelistic slant given to the village is the discussion of one building and its associated story that has been projected to open as part of the village. It hasn't opened yet, but it's one that there is in the planning stages. And it's the home of J.N. Loughborough, an early church leader. The story that will be highlighted in this site is that of the untimely deaths of Loughborough's wife and three children. The tour script will relate the sadness of this story, but then also claim the hopefulness of the second coming when Christ, quote, calls back to life all those who have died in the bright hope of resurrection, end quote. One article about this planned site and script also hints that it will address how Loughborough dealt with this event and how it may have affected his later work shaping the Adventist doctrine on the state of the dead. So there is this evangelistic slant to the presentation. And as we enter this kind of territory of death, of the end and meaning of life or the meaninglessness of life, of the hope for something beyond death, and as we approach proposed answers to these ultimate questions in this context, salvation, the second coming of Christ, as these things are archived in the collective memory and beliefs of this community, we enter the territory of Jacques Derrida, writing about the archive and the ultimate questions associated with it. In Archive Fever, Derrida offers an analysis of the notion of the archive, and in doing so helpfully expands the concept and theory of the archive. One way that he expands the notion of the archive is that he defines it more broadly than the traditional paper archive. Consequently, in thinking about archive as it relates to the historic Adventist village, we may think in terms of the written history left by the church's founders, the ritual history of the community's religious practices, the doctrinal history of the church's tenets, and also the stories and doctrines as they are archived or imprinted on the buildings in these stories, and the way these stories and doctrines are further archived in the collective memory of the church and individual believers and in the church as a whole, in what Derrida calls this psychic archive of the community and of individuals. Derrida identifies four principles of the archive: commencement, commandment, domiciliation, and consignation. The beginning, the powers that command the beginning of an archive. The archive is an actual physical place, the domicile, going back to the ancient Greeks when the archive existed in the house of magistrates and of officers, and so was actually given a physical place. And then the power of consignation, or the gathering together of signs, which aims to coordinate a single corpus in a system or synchrony in which all the elements articulate the unity of an ideal configuration. This ideal configuration, you can think of it in terms of, you know, hierarchical arrangement and description of an archival collection. You can also think about it in this expanded sense as a formulated body of doctrine and belief, or an internally coherent narrative of belief that support the memory and identity of a community. Derrida also discusses two places of inscription. Thank you. And again, this is two places of inscription, which he talks about printing, and he talks about circumcision of the actual physical body. Using these two places of inscription, Derrida explains his idea of a spectrum of substrates from public to private, exterior to interior, physical to immaterial, on which memory is archived. This raises the question for Derrida of where the line is between public and private, and also how far into the interior and private we may posit that the archive drive penetrates and that archives exist. Out of this develops the idea of a psychic archive distinct from spontaneous memory. In addition to all else that may populate this psychic archive, it may be seen as the place for religious belief and stories of belief to dwell, the place where believers are marked or imprinted by the beliefs and worldview of their community, the place of these marks, domiciliation, and consignation. But what of commencement and commandment? Where and why do these beliefs begin? Who or what commands this archivization? What lies behind the drive to build the historic Adventist village and through it to commemorate the Adventist past and the beliefs to which this past witnesses? There may be many answers to these questions, but the context within which Derrida writes gets to the most basic fears and questions that people archive in order to address. Archive, and Derrida speaking, would be talking about a lot of different things: archiving, preserving, hiding, sheltering. Derrida argues that the archive will never be memory as spontaneous, alive, and internal experience. On the contrary, the archive takes place at the place of originary, and a lot of these are quotes, I have quotes interspersed in here, the place of originary and structural breakdown of the said memory. The place, in Nara's words, of the rupture from lived memory, making a connection there. If we are thinking of archive as the psychic archive, we may conclude that religious beliefs and stories are archived in memory because of, or in response to, the real experience of existential angst, the fear of death and oblivion. The rupture experienced by a religious community in the 20th and 21st centuries, rupture from its lived memory, co-occurs with the general rupture in society caused by postmodernism, in which stability and meaning in any sense are challenged. It is this instability, whether acknowledged or not, that causes religious believers to hold on to and support beliefs that offer comfort and hope. The sentiment expressed in Adventist Heritage Ministry publications that contemporary Adventists have lost touch with the pioneers' strong faith and sacrificial acts and need to get back to that spirit is a masked fear that those pioneers' faith and acts were all for naught, that perhaps now, 160-plus years past the date that the original Adventist believers thought that Christ would return, it is time to reassess the church's beliefs and reasons for being. If not, then it is time, instead, as is actually happening, to look back to history and heritage for reassurance that the church is still participating in a divine plan. The focus of these archived artifacts and stories at this village is an attempt to restore shaken belief, to cover the rupture between past and present, lived memory, and the stark light of critical history, belief, and facts. Archive fever, according to Derrida, is the inextricable relationship between the archive drive and the death drive. The archive's consignation in an external place assures the possibility of memorization, of repetition, of reproduction, and the repetition compulsion remains, according to Freud, indissociable from the death drive. The consequence is that right on that which permits and conditions archivization, we will never find anything other than that which exposes to destruction. The archive always works, and a priori against itself, Derrida says. The Adventist Great Disappointment of 1844, which I referred to at the beginning, is archived in Adventist history and beliefs, and holds or hides or shelters or archives within itself the seeds of the destruction of the archive of belief. The event, and then the doctrine created in response to the event, carry, in turn, the failure of hope that the early Adventists suffered, and the hope for salvation and the second coming that today still supports belief. This story of this disappointment, sheltered in an introductory paragraph near the beginning of this paper, holds the fear that this earthly life is all there is and that there is no salvation or life after death. As if an illustration of Derrida's claim that the possibility of archivization is indissociable from the death drive, and that the archive always works against itself, the Great Disappointment functions as a formative event which Adventists still look back to now in a positive light, and which hides within itself an ultimate fear, a fear that was at the time explained away and hidden by further Bible study and the development of an archive of doctrine, through which the church could explain where they had gone wrong and still be assured that Christ's return was imminent. Now today, 160 plus years later, the glaring absence of Christ's second coming continues to be explained and hidden by beliefs and activities of the church. One activity in particular which I have examined here is the historic Adventist village, in which believers seek a recovery of the sights and stories and the very air of an earlier time. This village is informed by the culture's wider history and heritage movements and the desire to nurture community, as well as by the need to protect and shelter belief from doubt in order to restore and maintain confidence in the hope for salvation and eternal life. Thanks.
Thank you for three very interesting papers. We now have time for questions, 45 minutes. You don't have to stand up. I think it's a rather small group, but identify yourself before you ask a question.
My name is Joe Tringham. Jonathan?
Yeah.
I was just wondering, you were talking at the beginning, you said you often looked at some 5 o'clock and some primary sources. I was just wondering where they were, if they were at the church or if they were in a public institution, or people the church knew who were studying there, and what their response was, if they were supportive as possible.
When I went on the tour, I had a tour guide, and it was like near the end of the season, so I was the only person there. And it was kind of that was an interesting experience, because I kind of, beforehand, I couldn't decide, do I want to tell them of my connection or not, or kind of, be anonymous, and I went ahead and told him that I had grown up in the Adventist church, and I told him kind of vaguely that I was working on a paper. He didn't really seem that interested in, I'm glad, because I'm not sure I would have been able to explain exactly what my slant was. They had a bunch of just newsletters lying around, and they said, yeah, take them, take whatever you want. So I got those as primary sources, and then I also went to Andrews University, which is an Adventist college and university in Michigan, and they have an archive there of Adventist history, and so I saw a lot of primary source documents there as well.
Yes, please.
Could you extend your analysis to Henry Ford's village? I assume you're familiar with it.
I actually have been intending to go there as kind of a comparison to this and haven't made it there yet, but now I wish I had. But yeah, it's...
I would love to hear what Derrida would say about it.
I would encourage to comparison with other religious institutions that are using these type of historic sites to spread their message. You said at some point you didn't use the word proselytize, but I got the sense that was part of it to get people interested in religion. And that would be, if you could find other religions that would do it, that would be really good.
Yes, please.
Well, along those lines, I was thinking when you were showing your slides how much the village looks like Shakertown, and I've forgotten the name now, but in Kentucky. And the Shakers didn't marry and then have children generally as part of their religious community. And so I've often thought that the reason the Shakers have sort of created this village and have sort of fascinated in time is the sense of keeping the memory and documenting their way of life and their belief system in a way that they can't, that a lot of people do by having children and building families, but that instead they did it with a village. And so I actually think that there's a lot of parallels between Shakertown and this village that you...
That would be an interesting thing. Where did you say?
I think it's Pleasant Ridge or Pleasant Valley or something like that.
Okay.
I actually have a question for Eric. I'm interested in the motivation of people who do the tagging of archival resources.
Yeah, actually nailing down what might motivate a tagger is something, or somebody that might tag a website is something somewhat difficult to nail down. I mean, one of the things that we can see is always going to be the possibility that those capacities might be on a particular website or might be part of an archival website, but it still might not be utilized in one way or another. But typically, some of the things that will motivate someone to participate, to offer additional description, will revolve around there being some sort of connection, whether it's intellectual or some sort of research interest that they might have with this particular material. Or there might be some sort of identification with the material in one way or another, in terms of maybe there might be some sort of relationship, either in terms of family or if it's an organization, they might have worked there or known someone that worked there or something like that in an archival collection. But actually, like, motivating users to actually provide description is going to be one of the things that might be vexing for, I don't know, the progress of social tagging or of using this to generate descriptive metadata.
I have a question for Eric as well. What about is there any way to ensure accuracy in these tags? If somebody goes onto an archival site and tags something erroneously, is there any way to ensure that doesn't happen?
Yeah, I mean, to some degree, one of the things that will often happen, assuming that there is going to be more than just one individual, would be there would eventually be, with individuals tagging, some sort of a consensus. One of the possibilities that some information scientists have discussed is actually like sort of farming that material, or I don't know, pruning might be a better way of describing it, that for those things that are inaccurate, that maybe those things might be pulled out or something like that. But one of the clear ways that there will be, I guess, some sort of constraint on it is usually going to be some sort of feedback among the different individuals that would be tagging that material.
In your research on social tagging, did you take a look at the polar bear?
Mm-hmm. Yep, I sure did. I cited it in my bibliography, but you'd be surprised how fast 15 minutes goes.
No, oh, man. Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, they have a sort of a vetting process, mm-hmm. where the information is actually reviewed by individuals who might know what the context is, and then before it's actually posted. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yeah, as far as I understand. One of the other things, just returning back to the motivation thing that had come up earlier, if I'm not mistaken, about the polar bear collection, one of the typical ways in which individuals will participate with that collection, will tag or will offer information up, will be some sort of connection that they might have, a grandfather or something like that.
Right, absolutely.
But yeah, I mean, the possibility of sort of vetting the information might certainly be one way of ensuring accuracy. Even if somebody might be maybe incorrect, but not maliciously incorrect or something else, if there is maybe no identification of that picture or anything like that, it might be perhaps in the general ballpark or something like that as well, or at least a point to perhaps research and verify.
I have a question for Eric. My name is Paul Rogers, I'm in Yosemite. We basically only post finding aids and not really items up on the web. And so I'm curious about if you've thought at all about carrying this over to in-person interviewers or researchers that come in, because they oftentimes will have details and comments, but there's really no easy way for them to kind of transfer that knowledge like you could on the web. So I think it's just as important to try and capture that, but there's no easy way to do that.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm in complete agreement about that. I mean, one of the examples I bring up is going to be project naming, the efforts that Library and Archives Canada had undergone interviewing different Inuit elders. And it could be a similar sort of situation, something face-to-face, too. It by no means needs to be, get the information, I suppose, where you can. And it by no means needs to be something digital or Web 2.0. But yeah, you present some interesting aspect of it. I'm not too sure how it would get incorporated into a finding aid, but there would always be the possibility, perhaps, of just in line with Web 2.0 technology, perhaps maybe presenting some sort of blog on something like that, or if moving towards some sort of technological venue for it was what was desired. But you're absolutely right that it's important to get the information wherever it might be derived from, whether it's online or in person.
Jonathan, need a question?
Yeah,
Well, yeah, I think mine was kind of related to that. I was just wondering if there was much thought about tagging for the collections where it's just the finding aid that exists online. If that would be helpful or not.
It very well might be. I was basically looking to the possibility of papers or, mm-hmm. or photographs or something like that, but the idea of tagging a finding aid would certainly be a possibility. I mean, theoretically, anything online could theoretically be tagged, unless I've misunderstood something grievously. That would be the case.
I also have a question for Katie. Archival tribes are generating administrative materials right now, and this made me thinking of tribal archives in general. Do they have the resources to accurately process records, and also when records come back, to take care of them accurately?
Well, I think there's various levels of, I don't know the correct word, various levels of support that tribes have. Some of the tribes, this is a very intertwined topic too, because some of the tribes also are able to generate revenue through casinos. And so the ones that I've looked at that have casinos, many of them have built museums and archives or libraries, and they're definitely able to support them. And of course, I can't remember the one right now, but it's in New England somewhere.
Pequot,
thank you. Yep. The Pequot have this, from what I've seen on their website, which is also very great. There's not a great web presence either, but they have a wonderful library, museum, and archives all combined together, and so they're really able to support and educate their users or their tribal members and other people. But then, of course, I guess the second level of that would be the tribes that collaborate with universities, governments, and maybe with other tribes, and with grants. And I think with the collaboration, they're able to, you know, preserve these documents and make them accessible. But the really small tribes, there's a million little missions all over California that I don't know if they even have a records person or a librarian or archivist. And it seems to be the case that most tribes are having this problem that they just don't have the revenue or maybe the support or knowledge. A lot of people don't know what archives are in our society in general either. So I would say there's those three levels to it, depending on the traditions, the status, and if they can have casinos or not.
Mm-hmm.
So it's complicated.
Is it important for those tribes to have an archivist who is from the tribe itself?
From what I've read and heard, that seems to be the preference, and that would make sense, so that they would understand the traditions and maybe some restrictions that they might want to put place. I know some Maori archives in New Zealand restrict some of their records to just tribal members or just men or just, it just kind of depends. So I think it's very important so they understand actually the culture. But I know someone who is a non-Native American who is a tribal archivist, and she's doing her best to learn the language and to gain insight. And I think there has to be kind of a balance between someone who has a knowledge of the archival process and records management, things like that, but yet also who knows about the tribe, because they're so different. Each tribe is unique. Mm-hmm. So.
Thanks. Yes, please.
My boss, Amy Cooper Carey, she told me about the SWARP project, and so that got me interested in this whole subject, and then it just turned out that SAA was looking at the Native American protocol, so it was just really great timing and a few interesting
articles and projects.
Yes, please.
Just to tag on to this, I went to grad school with an archivist who was for Lamy, and they were doing it because in order to get federal recognition, they had to have an archive first. So one of the things I'm kind of curious, is that what most tribes are trying to do, or is there other reasons that they're trying to do this?
That's a very good question. I'm not quite sure, and I would think it would depend on the status of the tribe. Like you've said, I've come across a tribe in Wisconsin near the area where I grew up that they're not federally recognized either, so they're trying to get that going as well. I think the major issue is land claims and just trying to decide who has ownership of land, especially in the lucrative areas in the West. So I think that's also a case where it depends on the status of the tribes and what their needs are and what their resources are. So. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, so okay. It's more legal focused than just purely historical, trying to keep a collective memory.
Yeah, from what I've come across. But I think, it seemed with SWARP, it started out with legal and then it kind of became collective memory, and so that's an interesting bridge there. So I think they might be going that way.
So what kind of, is there work where they're trying to get in things into the archive that are kind of non-traditional, like oral histories or like recording dances or other cultural things that could be lost? Or?
There is. I know there's some cases in Alaska, where they have some oral, some songs, that's what it is, some songs that they were trying to keep. But then there's also the idea of the very different notions of history from what I've found with oral history, it seems like some tribes don't necessarily need a recording from a certain period because the song, in this instance, the song changes throughout the history of the tribe. So, yeah, that's another issue where, from what I've found, it seems to depend on the traditions and the tribe themselves. So, but yes, there are masks, and I know in some areas in Canada that there are masks and other non-traditional archival materials. And that's why archives and museums and libraries, from what I've found, seem to be either combined or very close with the tribes. And NAGPRA, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, has helped with that.
Any more questions? Otherwise, I would like to thank our three speakers for three very interesting papers and everyone else who was involved for an interesting discussion. Thank you very much.
I just also like to thank SAA for providing this opportunity for us students to get some practice and get some ideas. It's really wonderful. So thank you.